You're listening to Conversation with the Experts, a Royal Children's Hospital Education Hub podcast.
Hello, my name is Steve Lacey and I'm an Allied Health Clinical Educator for the Outreach Program in the RCH Education Hub. This year, we're talking a bit about pediatric vaccination, and most, if not all of us, would acknowledge the importance of vaccination and how they contribute to the management and prevention of disease. But we'd also be very much aware of the reluctance for a small percentage of the population who receive these vaccines, which can be frustrating for some. However, there are people who can be particularly concerned around those who have this vaccine hesitancy, and there are people who are hesitant about receiving these vaccines. And just to add to the complexities, in pediatrics, we have parents and caregivers who have their own vaccine hesitancy and may behave in a way that's not necessarily in the best interest of the child. Well, today I'm joined by Dr. Jessica Kaufman from the Vaccine Uptake Group in the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. Jess co-leads the Vaccine Champions Program in Australia and the Pacific region and is here to discuss vaccine hesitancy. Welcome, Jess.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with what I hope is going to be a simple question, and then we can get to the idea of the scope of this issue. What's the current rate of vaccination in Australia amongst children?
So Australia has very high vaccination rates for compared to other countries globally, and we've always had really good confidence in vaccines. That said, we have seen a little bit of a drop in the last 3 years. So I believe the current rate around for five-year-olds is around 94%, but the rate for 1 and 2 year olds is a little bit lower, so around 91 to 93% of the general population.
Is that just because people are a little bit late in getting people vaccinated, or is it just because there's a specific hesitancy in that
age group? There's a lot of questions, I guess, to unpack around why it's a little bit lower. Generally speaking, we think that the five-year-old vaccine catches up a little bit because the no jab, no play and the no jab, no pay policies come into effect when kids need to go to early childhood education and care. And so sometimes parents who were a little bit just delayed, didn't get around to it, kind of go, oh, now I've got to get them. And so they catch them all up at around age five.
Okay. That makes sense. Are there differences between states of Australia or specific groups of people?
So around the states, it's pretty similar. You know, we're looking at, differences of 1 or 2%. Mm-hmm. But there are some differences in different groups. Particularly, there's a lot of focus and interest in the gap between the general population and our First Nations kids. At age five, the rate of vaccination for First Nations kids is actually higher than it is for the general population, but it is a lot lower in the 1 and 2 year old bracket. And that's also dropped a little bit further in the last 3 years than the general population. So that's definitely a concern.
Yeah, right. Do you find that there is more hesitancy around particular vaccines or at different ages?
It really depends, but there are some sort of trends, I guess, or some commonalities around what concerns parents might have and which vaccines and when that might take place. So for instance, there's a common concern among parents is that kids get too many vaccines within the first 2 years of life. Mm-hmm. So they think that they're sort of overloaded with vaccines, where they may be less concerned about vaccines delivered a little bit later on, even though, as we all know, the immune system is very capable of addressing all of the antigens that we vaccinate them against when they're very young. The MMR vaccine, I'm sure everyone's aware, has a checkered past, a checkered history in terms of having been erroneously linked to autism through a study in the 90s. So there are some parents who are maybe comfortable with other vaccines but have some more concerns about MMR. And also there are some parents who are worried about sort of multivalent vaccines, the single jab with lots of different antigens in it. And just to say, the other vaccine I think that people look at a little bit differently is the HPV vaccine for a range of reasons. It's delivered at a completely different age. It is, related to sexual activity, and that can cause a lot of hesitancy among parents. And also there have been some pervasive myths around the HPV vaccine affecting fertility in the future. Yeah. So that's a type of hesitancy that parents can have.
Okay. So that kind of brings me to the next question, because I think we were talking a little bit about why people are quite hesitant. We do acknowledge that it does exist, that vaccine hesitancy is a thing, even though the efficacy of vaccination we can see would far outweigh any of those types of risks in that. So why do we think that it really does exist? Like, what's the psychology around that?
Well, look, there's not a single explanation for hesitancy. And I know we're talking about hesitancy here, but I also do just want to make a point that there are also really important access-based reasons that people may or may not vaccinate. So I just want to make sure that, you know, even when we're looking at uptake rates in different populations being lower or something like that, you know, we don't want to always jump to the assumption that it is hesitancy. Mm-hmm. That said, hesitancy really comes from generally, you know, it's a risk-benefit assessment that parents are making.
Yeah.
You know, that everybody wants the best for their kids. And so it's about how they assess the risk of a potential disease versus what they perceive to be potential risks of a vaccine.
Yeah.
And different people make that decision in different ways. And there are some sort of mental shortcuts that we use as humans to assess risk. And they're not always really logical. You know, we're not always very swayed by numbers. Like you said, oh, we know that it's more effective, you know, that the risks really outweigh the potential harms. But you're asking parents to give a child who is well an invasive treatment, a medicine, for something that isn't currently affecting them and may never affect them.
Yeah.
You know, and so they have to kind of overcome that fear that they're going to maybe hurt their child, even just temporarily with the needle. Also that their child might feel sick afterwards and that, you know, the side effects of the vaccine, even the common and expected side effects, you know, can be inconvenient and can be distressing for parents. And then that's, you know, to say nothing about parents who are worried about, you know, the rare serious adverse events or even just misinformation that they've heard about those, and feeling that intense responsibility to make the right decision is something that can cause some parents to choose to do nothing. So
right.
That sort of idea that if I take no action, that's somehow better than if I take an action that might actually hurt my child.
Yeah. It's a little bit like insurance really, isn't it? When you think about it, you know, you don't buy the insurance because you don't want to have that immediate loss of money.
Exactly.
Even though you're insuring yourself against something that might happen in the future, but it may not happen and you never know. So it's very similar, I think, in that sense.
And I think one of, you know, we're a victim of our own success in a lot of ways in Australia, that because childhood vaccination rates are so high, the risk of a lot of these diseases is very low. And there is a very real phenomenon of parents hiding in the crowd, essentially. You know, I don't need to vaccinate my child because I know everyone else is vaccinating their child. But you know, you only
herd immunity type.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You only need a couple parents who think like that for measles though. So
exactly. Let's look at the common reasons or misconceptions that might contribute to vaccine hesitancy. Now you did mention the one before about the link to autism and that. So that came from, you said, a paper in the 90s. Can you talk a little bit more about that one and what other ones we regularly hear about?
You know, a lot of damage can be done with poor scientific research. I guess one thing to say to set up this issue in the first place is the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, was traditionally delivered around age 4 in a lot of high-income countries. And that is also happens to be when some of the first signs of autism are often diagnosed among children. So this is, you know, two things that happen around the same time. And autism is poorly understood and certainly was even more poorly understood when the vaccine was sort of new, in terms of what might cause it. And so parents are looking for a cause for the autism, as are providers and as are our researchers.
Yeah.
So into that context, Andrew Wakefield, a doctor, did some research where he looked at, you know, 12 people, a very small study that turned out to have a lot of fraudulent data. But he was looking at the gut-brain connection. So I'm trying to understand whether, you know, things that happen in the gut could actually cause brain issues like autism. And he published this paper that showed that according to him, that the MMR vaccine could cause autism. What was unclear at the time before this paper was retracted was, you know, he didn't consent the people properly. He made up some of the data. And also he had a financial stake in a monovalent version of the vaccine that was going to be broken up. And so his recommendation based on this paper was going to be, you should use my special vaccine that isn't a combined version of this vaccine.
Right.
So there were lots of ulterior motives there. And anyway, this paper was entirely retracted, you know, but it was retracted in 2010. So it was out there for over a decade.
Yeah, the damage had been done already.
Exactly. And so this is a really pervasive concern. We did some research before the pandemic that showed that the concern that vaccines cause autism was maybe waning a little bit, which was really encouraging. And then just recently, we did some research with the Royal Children's Hospital Child Health Poll, where we repeated some questions they had asked in 2017, but in 2023. And we found a huge increase in the concern or the belief that vaccines cause autism. So what we're really worried about is, how has the pandemic affected people's understanding of vaccines and people's belief in misinformation about vaccines. So that's one of the main, I guess, concerns or misperceptions about vaccination.
Yeah, right. And I think that also kind of brings into the concept of the rise of the use of social media as well, because yes, we've had the pandemic between 2017 and 2023, but we've also had a big rise in social media, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years as well. How has this spread of information affected vaccine hesitancy? Like, are there any specific concerns that relate to misinformation in the Australian context?
Well, look, social media absolutely put misinformation on steroids. It goes faster, further. It reaches more people now than it ever has, certainly. And that has really been amplified through COVID. I mean, one of the things that we've seen throughout the COVID pandemic, which I think is still continuing, is the rise of bad actors actually spreading disinformation, sometimes from other countries, you know, actively seeding false information to cause concern and cause division within society or and cause debate and sort of destabilize, you know, a whole health system. So that's one element of vaccine misinformation that's being spread. But also the main thing that social media does is it gives individuals a platform for their own experiences. And that's kind of the good thing about social media too. But when you see a story, a video, or a really heart-wrenching story from a person who says that they or their child has been vaccine injured, you know, that is still just one person. It's not fact-checked, but it is very powerful and emotional, and it reaches now so many more people. And so that's really the type of misinformation that's quite challenging to counter. And so a lot of what we're trying to do in our research now is not rebut individual myths as we find out about them, but actually try and teach people to have that critical thinking skill to understand, hey, that sounds really sensational. I better check that, you know, or I'm not sure about that source. I better, you know, look for another source to verify what I've seen. And, you know, we have to start with kids as well, but even in the general population, teaching some of those resilient skills so that they're not as convinced by the misinformation that they're inevitably going to come across in social media is kind of the current approach, I guess, to trying to combat that.
It's kind of almost like, you know, there's not really any point in putting out the tiny spot fires when there's a massive bushfire coming your way and you know that you've actually got to do more to protect yourself against it. So,
yeah. I mean, look, in an individual consultation, you know, between one parent and one healthcare provider, there can be a lot of value in, you know, reassuring them, countering a myth that they bring to you and that they've shared with you. But on a population level, it's too difficult. It's too, you know, it's too much of a moving feast. You can't really put out those little spot fires, like you said.
Yeah. Now we have the complexity of parents refusing for their children. And I'd like to think of this as having two groups here. So on the one hand, you have the younger child whose parents are making all of the decisions for them. And you have a separation of hesitancy from the individual to the child. But on the other hand, you have the adolescent groups who may be able to consent to having their own vaccination and may be able to make their own informed choices, but the parents are still refusing. So how do we tackle those situations?
This became a much bigger issue through COVID, didn't it? When, you know, there were kids out there who were really interested, really wanted to get the COVID vaccines and their parents were resisting. And I think this is, you know, it's a complicated issue. It's around assessing competency to make that decision. So there's not like an absolute hard and fast rule about what age a child can provide consent for themselves to get a vaccine. But, you know, as a provider, as an immunization provider, you'd be assessing, you know, the GILIC competency, their competency to understand what they're, you know, asking, what the side effects might be, you know, what's involved in that decision. And if that person is 14 years old and expresses, you know, sufficient competency, then yes, yeah, you know, we can vaccinate them. That doesn't mean there is never going to be conflict in that decision with the parents, you know, if there's conflict between parents. So the first step, I guess, is really about trying to get agreement and understanding and not doing this, you know, behind people's backs, but actually bringing everybody together and trying to have that conversation and actually reach consensus from the parents and the child.
Yeah, right, okay. We'd all like to think that we as healthcare professionals would be modeling that behavior that we would expect of the public when it comes to general health. But in fact, we're not actually all that great at this. For example, there are still health professionals that smoke. There are some that drink, some that binge drink. in my personal experience, there's some that still don't understand the concept of the use of radiation when it comes to medical imaging. And there are some that have their own vaccine hesitancy as well. So this became much more apparent during the pandemic, where some staff refused to get the COVID vaccine and actually ended up having to leave their job. It had a huge effect on workforce shortages though, didn't it?
The number one issue with hesitancy among health workers is that they will then be reluctant to recommend vaccination to all of the people in their care, right? So it's not just the individual making the decision not to vaccinate themselves. You know, the recommendation to vaccinate from a health provider is like the number one driver of vaccine uptake across the lifespan. Mm. And so if you have a provider who is even just wishy-washy about it, you know, it has a really big knock-on effect for everyone that they speak to about the vaccines. And, you know, ultimately, I think there were a range of reasons for workforce shortages. Certainly the refusal to vaccinate was one, but we also talked to a lot of people. Like, we did some research with pregnant women who were pregnant at the time of the mandates and were also health workers. And they were sort of saying, you know, they got the vaccines, but it was complicated. It was a complicated decision. It was complicated for a lot of people. And so even just that feeling of being pressured or of being, you know, not adequately supported to make that decision, that can also have that knock-on effect of how comfortable you feel making a recommendation moving forward.
Yeah. And do you think that certain ideologies of these kind of clinicians could be passed on to their patients and the patients' parents and caregivers?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I was saying, you know, if you even say, I'm not sure if I would get that vaccine, really strong association with your patients, then also saying, oh, I don't know if I'll get that vaccine. One of the big things to deal with vaccine hesitancy or tackling vaccine hesitancy is providing adequate training and support and resources for healthcare providers so that they can all sort of, you know, own that information and understand that information and know how to have those conversations effectively.
Right. So before we finish, can you tell us a little bit more about the Vaccine Champions program that you run?
Sure. So the Vaccine Champions program is based on the idea that people are influenced by the people that they already have relationships with. So other people in their communities, and that's, you know, sometimes it's faith leaders or, you know, people who work for sporting organizations or whatever, anybody that you might already sort of have a relationship with, and teachers. And so starting during the pandemic, but continuing now, we went to a number of different countries and worked with Fiji and Tonga and Vietnam. Now we're working in Indonesia and the Philippines to co-design a version of a training program that basically empowers whoever is, you know, a community influencer in that setting to have a conversation about vaccines, to advocate for vaccination. And, you know, importantly right now, it's really about advocating for childhood vaccination. You know, it's dropped significantly around the world, particularly in Indonesia and the Philippines. And so we run these training programs and then we support the champions to actually run, you know, information sessions and to have conversations within their communities about vaccination. And so that kind of community engagement approach is really what we're sort of targeting now.
Yeah, and then the community members are the ones who are actually getting the information from people that they trust and that they know, rather than someone external coming in and saying, hey, you should be getting this vaccination. They're actually, you know, it's someone they know and that they can understand.
Exactly. You know, and also, you know, people can share their own experience, particularly with the COVID vaccine. It made a really big difference for people to say, I was vaccinated. This is what happened. You know, this is how it went for me. Mm. And I, you know, these were my side effects. Faith leaders in particular can be a really important advocate if they sort of stand up in front of their congregation, for instance, and say, this is something that we support, you know, in this organization. That has a really strong impact. So sometimes people don't feel like it's part of their, or they're not confident that they know enough about it, or that they don't feel empowered to have that kind of conversation. And that's really where we're sort of targeting the Champions training program.
Yeah. And I think people probably relate more to the lived experience type situations, don't they?
Yeah.
Jess, thank you very much for joining me today. Do you have any last minute tips for clinicians or resources that they can access around vaccine hesitancy?
I do. I would highly recommend that any clinician or even member of the public who's interested in getting some more information about vaccines, but also in some training about how to have effective conversations about vaccination, checks out the Sharing Knowledge About Immunization website, which is called skai.org.au. And that is a really comprehensive website that we've developed, supported by the Commonwealth Government, to put together information on childhood vaccines, maternal vaccination. It's being expanded now to different vaccination groups, and it's sort of all in one place, one-stop shop. So we really recommend taking a look at that if you're interested in finding out more.
Wonderful. That's perfect. Thanks a lot, Jess. We're going to have these in our show notes as well for clinicians to access as well. Jess, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Conversation with the Experts, part of the Royal Children's Hospital Education Hub podcast series. If you'd like to hear more of our podcasts, check out our other podcast show, Teach, Think, Treat, where we discuss aspects related to teaching and learning in a busy clinical setting.